Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. The principles of national security and neighbors' territorial integrity have never been perfectly aligned, but the arrival of Donald Trump onto the global stage added even more tension to this already a boiling contradiction. Will the countries now have to agree on a new set of boundaries when it comes to defending national borders? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Ambassador Asif Durrani, Pakistan's former special representative to Afghanistan and currently a senior research fellow at the Islamabad Policy Research Institute. Ambassador, it's a great honor for me to talk to you. Thank you very much for being available.
Thank you for having me.
Now, let me start with something that is very close to your home. Late last year, Pakistani and Indian media were buzzing with discussion on Pakistan's strikes on one of the Afghanistan's provinces. And I know it's a big thing for the two countries, but I also noticed that internationally, you know, many other countries were sort of doing a similar kinetic thing, because at that time, Israel and Turkey were moving far more boldly on into the Syrian territory. There's Russia's presence in Ukraine. We know about Israel's operation in Gaza. Donald Trump is now talking about expanding American borders officially by acquiring Greenland and Canada. I wonder if you take that all as sort of isolated incidents, or do you think perhaps some of the countries have become far more liberal when it comes to redrawing the map?
I think we are mixing many issues together. The first is no two situations are similar. You refer to Pakistan strikes. That was a result of the intelligence-based report that TTP terrorists were holed up and they were planning. So those were precision strikes based on intelligence, and none of the Afghan nationals were killed. One. And then a similar strike took place way back in March last year also. Again, the same intelligence base. The reason was that these TTP people, they are taking shelter in Afghanistan. They are, as per the UN reports, close to 6,000. And they are the largest group so far as far as foreign terrorists are concerned. Apart from ISKP, then Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, and then ETIM.
It's a long-running problem, but it's a problem that's positioned outside your borders. And you know that according to the international law, all countries have to respect the neighbor's borders. So there's always a controversy whenever somebody crosses into somebody else's
territory.
I agree.
This was not a classical violation. What about the TTP attacks on Pakistan positions joined by the Afghan nationals? It is not a TTP exclusive attacks on Pakistan security forces, civilians, and so they have indulged in death and destruction. And then what about ISKP people who have done their attacks in Kermanshah in Iran, in Moscow, and in Pakistan? So you have to actually address these issues in right earnest. You cannot mix, and the sovereignty comes when the other side also respects the sovereignty of others.
Now, my question is not to criticize Pakistan by any measure. I'm not an expert on that. But I wonder if perhaps the current framework of international law, not only by the fact that many countries seem to be ignoring it, but by the fact that it doesn't seem to solve the issues that you have just raised, whether that framework needs to be updated, revised, brought in touch with reality somehow.
Well, those you are referring to, I can understand that. Those are the movers and shakers in the world. When you included Pakistan into that, then I think
you think it's
that
a separate
was
case.
Not a right analogy drawing on that. Mm-hmm. Each situation, as I said in the beginning, is different. So when they talk about Iceland or for that matter annexing Mexico and Canada. So that's, we all know under the international law. That is actually attack on the sovereignty. And one in which you are in a state of war, and the same United States and NATO forces, they entered into Doha agreement in Afghanistan, shook hand, and left smilingly. Now, they have left their land where our dispensation is ruling. We respect that, but at the same time,
they left you with a lot of problems.
We are facing the problem.
Absolutely.
So if you are in my shoes, how you are going to address that?
I'm not qualified to answer that question. That's why I'm interviewing you. But can I double check the second part of my question? Do you think that the international environment, or sort of the current ethos, has become somewhat more permissible to redrawing the borders or crossing into the neighboring territory a little bit more sort of carefree than it used to be?
I think that's a loose talk, and we should discourage that talk. And redrawing of the borders means it would actually bring the peace and security in the world to danger. So this is something, it's a dangerous talk.
Do you think there could be any joint international action? Because I remember a couple of years back, there was a lot of talk, at least from the Russian side, about the shared security principle, you know, all major powers and regional powers committing to the principle of not advancing their security at the cost of their neighbor. Do you think it's realistic to perhaps come back to that principle or invent some other?
I think we have to go back to the drawing board, and we have to discuss this in a thorough manner, and we should not leave this to some political mavericks that they decide about anything. And this is not the way of conducting international business.
Now, can I ask you specifically about ways of conducting international business? Because Afghanistan's or the Taliban's policy or sort of style of international engagement seems to be very idiosyncratic, because on some issues they seem to be very unconventional, let's put it that way. For example, refusing to issue passports to their citizens for crossing into Pakistan, for example. But on other matters, like negotiating with the Indians, they seem to project an image of a fully fledged diplomatic power. How do you sort of see, how do you characterize this foreign policy approach?
Well, you have said it. I think Taliban are still learning, and we hope that they learn quickly about the conduct of relationship. What does it mean to respect the sovereignty and integrity of each other's borders? And what does it mean that in the economic realm, how to behave, how to grant access to each other and in the region. It is a win-win situation. So we hope that the interim government in Afghanistan will take measures that will be beneficial for the people of Afghanistan.
Do you think they are genuinely not aware of how to do those things and need to learn, or are they perhaps using some loopholes in behaving in a certain way when it pleases them with one nation and showing a different face with another?
I don't think so. I think if that's the case, then I think it's a clever by half move, because if they think that perhaps they will refuse one nationals not to have passports. And this is not the case. I think you have to check your facts, because we issue almost 3,000 visas per day. Mm-hmm. It's the highest number perhaps anywhere in the world where such number of visas are issued. Taliban should also know that they have five other neighbors also. They cannot, use the concessions which Pakistan used to give them. That was not available to them with other five neighbors.
Mm-hmm. And you wrote recently that President Karzai used to call Pakistan and Afghanistan Siamese twins that cannot be separated. Do you agree with him? And would you want Pakistan to be in such a symbiotic relationship with any other nation?
I have no doubt about it that there's a symbiotic relationship between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Again, it's quite exceptional that 17 tribes are actually on the border. This is not the case with Afghanistan's other five neighbors, which we have between Pakistan and Afghanistan. So, and then common ethnicities there. And more so, for instance, they have Tajiks, Uzbeks, and Turkmens, but they culturally don't identify themselves with the Tajiks, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, or Turkmenistan, because there is a cultural gap which has come. And they are more conservative here in the Tajiks, Uzbeks, and Turkmens who live in Afghanistan. So there is, it's a peculiar situation.
Do you think it is a special case? I mean, can it be ruled ultimately by the international law? Because what you're describing seems to be a very peculiar situation dealing with the, you know, very traditional culture that is very different from even Pakistan's culture. I mean, urban Pakistan culture. So do you think perhaps then this border needs to be given some sort of an exception in how it's dealt?
You have to keep on trying. The reason is that on the border. Now, it's not a good example, but polio virus is prevalent only on Pakistan-Afghanistan border. Because and the polio virus has been ended, it is finished all over the world, but it is there. That's because of the cultural ethos which are applied there. Because they think that if they get the polio virus drops or shots, so their children may become impotent. Nonsensical, but this is being pursued. So there are peculiarities, but you have to gradually tell the people that there is a way to interact. No one is stopping Afghans coming to Pakistan. No one is stopping Pakistanis to go to Afghanistan. But those who are coming from Afghanistan, they have to adopt a way which is internationally accepted. They go for Hajj. They go on passports. They cannot imagine going to Saudi Arabia without passport or any other country without passport. So I think this is gradually they will know, they will learn.
Well, Ambassador, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Counter the Russian state-controlled narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez, monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays. On est en France, quoi. C'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Asif Durrani, former Pakistan's special representative on Afghanistan and currently a senior research fellow at the Islamabad Policy Research Institute. Ambassador, just before the break, we started talking about Afghanistan, and you mentioned, in addition to Pakistan, its other neighbors, and I think it's through the intervention, somewhat informal intervention of its other neighbors that Afghanistan is sort of kept afloat, certainly not flourishing, but I think both Russia and Central Asian republics are maintaining contacts, trying to make sure, perhaps for their own good, that Afghanistan does not regress into chaos. Now, is it good enough for now? Do you see any opportunities for something more inspiring, I guess, or economically viable.
It is certainly not good enough, but at the same time, I think credit should go to Afghanistan's immediate neighbors and Russia for sustaining Afghanistan economically, even if at least subsistently. So this subsistence level is through the currency swap and through barter trade, and which is floating Afghanistan. But situation is grave. There's 97% poverty in Afghanistan, out of which 52% are actually dependent on international humanitarian assistance. And unfortunately, that international humanitarian assistance is dwindling. In 2023, the commitment was made for $4.2 billion, but only one-third was actually delivered to Afghanistan. Same happened last year, around $3.4 billion commitment, only 0.5% was actually committed in Afghanistan.
So the country is essentially abandoned by its former partners, let's call it that way.
It is. In fact, Afghanistan does not figure in American or NATO countries' priorities.
Now, can I ask you specifically about that? Because you mentioned this rather hurried departure of the previous administration, but the new administration, the new American president, seems to have a great interest in rare earth materials, of which Afghanistan has plenty. And he recently came up with a rather unorthodox proposal for Gaza, suggesting to turn it into a Riviera. Do you expect any sort of creative ideas coming out of Washington that can bring some economic development or perhaps some focus at least to Afghanistan?
I don't think they were very much serious about lithium in Afghanistan. And you said they left hurriedly. No. They left under a plan because... Let me tell you, President Bush asked his generals, can we win the war? And the answer was no. And he said, then why are we wasting our blood and treasure in Afghanistan? Pull out. So he entered into an agreement with the Taliban and signed it. But it was implemented by President Biden. So it shows there was a bipartisan support to this pullout. Mm-hmm. So you can't say it was done in a hurry. Mm-hmm. It was well planned. They spent 20 years and they took and gave from Taliban to Taliban this power.
Okay, my question to you, do you believe that there is any possibility of them coming back, perhaps even in some sort of in a joint effort, let's say, with the Russians or the Saudis, because you know the results of the Riyadh talks.
That would be an unusual thing, rather a miracle, if that happens. Our joint efforts are made. Joint efforts are made for the good of the humanity, for good of the people. There is a need. There are no two opinions about that. That the powers, they should, in fact, sit together and they should talk about peace and also try to help in resolving disputes wherever they are.
Mm-hmm. Now, as I mentioned, in Riyadh, we had the Russian and the American delegation now talking about the potential for economic cooperation. At least they are studying whether it could be profitable, let's say, in energy sector or in Arctic cooperation. If that were to be extended to Afghanistan in a genuine manner, do you think that that it could move the situation off its current deadlock?
It will definitely make a difference, because right now Afghanistan is neglected. There's a need not to abandon Afghanistan, because my fear is that it was during Taliban's 1.0 when Afghanistan was neglected and 9/11 happened. There are same, you can say, all the signs as far as present-day Afghanistan is concerned with ISKP's activities and TTP and all, so they can go extraterritorial. Mm-hmm. So it's all the more necessary for the world to sit together and not isolate Afghanistan.
The reason I'm so sort of pressing on this issue is because we all heard about President Trump's mercantilist approach, and he seems to involve himself into, world problems only when he sees some rationale, some business rationale. And I wonder if indeed cooperating on Afghanistan together can bring some benefit, not only to, let's say, Russia and the United States, but also perhaps to a larger region, and most importantly, to the Afghanistani people themselves.
I think when it comes to business, and then I think there are opportunities for all the interested parties.
What about the Taliban? Do you because you mentioned about the aid paradigm and then you know humanitarian aid not being enough. Do you think they're actually ready not to be the receivers of aid, even though I know that a lot of their funds are now frozen by the Americans, but sort of enter into the negotiations with regional and global powers, on their own self-sufficient basis? Are they ready to be partners? Is there a mentality even of
doing business? Well, definitely there could be many ideas. Now, if you are talking about the Taliban, they may also have the idea how to earn money. The issue is that do they have the necessary expertise? Fine. It is not simple mathematics. 2 + 2 = 4.
You told me before the interview that your interest in Afghanistan became very concrete once the Soviet war or Soviet invasion, whatever you term it, even though in the Soviet Union they thought of it as brotherly help, Soviet involvement in Afghanistan began. And at that time, Saudi Arabia was a very important adversarial partner to the Soviet Union. But this time around, the Saudis played a very active role in bringing the Russians and Americans together. Do you think they too may have a role to play in Afghanistan in terms of expertise, in terms of, I don't know, maybe ideological or religious negotiation or liaisoning, whatever?
Most definitely, because Saudi Arabia enjoys respect, not only in Pakistan, but Afghanistan as well. And it's the place of holy shrines of Islam. No doubt, and then it is very appreciable that Saudi Arabia is playing a mediatory role between the U.S. and Russia. We hope that something positive will come out of it, and which will be to the benefit of the entire world.
Riyadh also offered its assistance in negotiating between, in mediating rather, between the Americans and the Iranians. And I know that you are very concerned about what may happen with Iran and its nuclear posture during the next 4 years of Trump. What worries you the most about it?
Well, again, as you said it, I think pushing Iran to the corner would be dangerous. Iran may be down after the Syrian, episode. But Iran is certainly not out. Iran is a power to be reckoned with. So there is a need to tread very carefully when we are addressing this entire gamut as far as Middle East is concerned. When you talk about Iran, it means then you cannot divorce it from the Middle East. And Iran has friends. I think I don't think that Iran is alone.
I also want to ask you about Iran's enemies or proclaimed enemies, because we are so used to the Sunni-Shia divide and foreign powers exploiting that schism, but with this new initiative by the Saudis to mediate between the Iranians and the Americans, how do you assess the state of the Saudi-Iranian relationship? Do you see some possibilities there?
You will agree that such a mediation would not come out of the blue. I think confidence has been built between Saudi and Iran. And again, China played a very positive mediatory role in bringing Saudi and Iran together. And they had to stop the rhetoric which they used to use against each other. So it is a positive development. And now if Saudi Arabia can play a mediatory role between United States and Iran, And if both the parties agree, I think then it would have same impact, which we can anticipate about Saudi mediatory role between America and Russia.
Mm-hmm. Now, we mentioned all the major powers of the region except one, India, and Prime Minister Modi was among the first leaders to call and congratulate Donald Trump on his victory. They also worked quite successfully during Trump's first term. We all know that in Trump's new team, there are lots of people of the Indian origin in official and unofficial capacities. For example, the vice president's wife is of Indian origin, and she has massive following on the internet. I know that Indian diaspora in America is very happy. Do you think that may impact big politics in any way? I mean, do you expect any changes in the Indian-American dynamic and how it may reflect on Pakistan?
It has already, I think, impacted. India is now America's strategic partner. And again, there has been bipartisan support, whether Democrats or Republicans. So it will have an impact. And I think we will formulate our response as the situation comes up. But of course, our major concern is disturbing the conventional balance in the region, like the talk of providing F-35 to India.
Well, to some extent, this balance has already been disrupted because India unilaterally made some decisions back in 2019 that somewhat changed the situation in Kashmir, at least. Now, my question to you, and I guess it's going to be the last question, many countries right now, due to Trump's somewhat unorthodox stance on foreign policy, are now revising their own domestic and foreign policy outreach. Have you seen any moves in Pakistan? Is Pakistan changing how it approaches its neighbors, you know, itself and its relationship with the big powers?
Since you talk about India's action in occupied Kashmir in August 2019, that is unacceptable, that is illegal, and it is against the UN resolutions. So in any case, India will not enjoy legitimacy as far as Indian occupied Kashmir is concerned. So we are very clear about it. Whatever occupation or repressive tactics they might want to use it. Building their economic or military muscle doesn't mean that they can browbeat Pakistan. And more importantly, Pakistan is not dependent on India. So that aspect is there. So in that respect, India becomes irrelevant for Pakistan as far as browbeating is concerned, or for that matter, Pakistan's dependence is concerned. Pakistan is not dependent. But at the same time, in the region, and then since both India and Pakistan are nuclear weapon states, missile states, so it is a cause for worry for all of us, those who want peace, stability in the region, in the neighborhood. So I think sanity should prevail. India, in fact, took the dangerous step in February 2019, when they attacked Pakistan, Balakor. So they, in fact, introduced the new normal in a nuclear environment. So I think the good sense would prevail, because otherwise it would spell disaster.
We mentioned quite a few miracles, or a possibility for miracles or turnaround on major problems throughout this interview. Do you believe something like that is possible between India and Pakistan, like some new vision, some new idea that brings both to
agreeable? It is definitely possible if there are friends who can play the role of a mediator. Like, say, 3 months ago, we were not expecting the talk of Saudi mediation between Russia and
United States,
or Saudis offering to mediate between Iran and America. So I think that can happen. That can happen.
Okay, well, let's keep our fingers crossed. But on this somewhat hopeful note, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.